This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I have two very special guests. I'm really excited to be talking to them about their wonderful book. The book we're going to talk about is called After Darwin, Literature, Theory, and Criticism in 21st Century, published by Cambridge University Press in 2023. It's an edited collection of essays, and I've got Professor Devin Griffith, who is a professor of English at the University of Southern California, and also Professor Diana Krizel, who is a professor of English at the University of Mississippi, with us. Devin and Diana, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Glad to be here.
Right. Before we start talking about the book, can you briefly introduce yourself and tell us about your field of expertise, and then maybe you can tell us why you decided to write a book called After Darwin? Devin, maybe we should start with you.
Sure. So my original background was in molecular biology. I worked in a lab for a while, was on a big research project, but got burned out on lab work, decided I didn't really like being in the lab, 60 hours a week, and I really wanted more time to think about ideas. And gravitated towards an English PhD after that. When I got to grad school, I realized I didn't have to leave science behind. I could work on the history and philosophy of science alongside literature and sort of see how they interact. There was somebody named George Levine, that was sort of one of his big projects over the course of his career that I was able to work with at Rutgers. So that's sort of how I threaded my way into this, and sort of the question of sort of Darwin and literary studies. And I'm excited to talk to you about it. Deanna can introduce herself a little bit, and then we can talk about where the book came from.
Great. Thanks, Devin. Yes, I'm Deanna Kreisel. I am not a scientist and have zero science background, pretty much. I came at this comment from a different angle. I got interested in environmental humanities and eco-criticism about 10 years ago. We were just talking about how long it's been since we started working together, and came to Darwin that way. Because we'd already done some editing together. So I'm not as much of a Darwin expert as Devin, but I am an environmental humanities person, eco-critic, interested in science, in that regard, from that angle. So
that's very exciting, because I guess before we recorded this interview, I mentioned that I studied environmental humanities as a PhD student, and I came to know Darwin and literary Darwinism, let's say, more scientific approach to literature towards Darwin. And as I said to you, my friend was studying evolutionary psychology. We had very little in common. So I'm interested to know how a scientist and literary scholar work together to write this book. So can you tell us about the idea of this book, and how was it to approach literature from maybe Devin, you from a more scientific background, and Deanna from a literary background?
Yeah, I think so. The original idea for this project was a series of talks given on panels at a meeting of North Atlantic Victorian Studies, actually in Florence, Italy, a long time ago. And I was involved with that. And coming out of that, we sort of wondered if we could sort of gather some of these papers and put them together as a collection. That original impulse kind of foundered. But along the way, I met Deanna and I started collaborating with her in this sort of working group that works on the question of sort of history of cultures of ecology, particularly in the context of Britain, but more broadly. And so through this workshop, as we sort of started asking the question about how do we think about the history of the environment, how does it intersect with aesthetic objects, we became close collaborators. We did some sort of work together. And so when somebody came to me and asked if we could revive this sort of project on the relationship between Darwin, philosophy, and literature, I asked Deanna, she'd be interested in sort of pursuing it with me. And fortunately, Deanna had been sort of gravitating towards Darwin, along with obviously environmental studies for a while.
Yeah, that's exactly how it happened. I have to say I came on board. I came for Devin and I stayed for the Darwin. We had done an edited journal issue together called Open Ecologies, which was a special issue of Victorian Literature and Culture about a year before. And we really enjoyed working together and it was a really successful project. And so when Devin said, hey, I'm doing this After Darwin thing, would you like to come on board as a co-editor? I said, sure, let's do another editing project together. And that's how that part came about. But it was really fun and intellectually really challenging, but also extremely enlightening for me. I mean, I feel like I learned a lot just doing this editing project.
Yeah, I think when you're collaborating, the sum of 1 + 1 is a lot bigger than 2. Mm-hmm. And if you can find somebody to work with who you really enjoy and is a good friend, it's just like one of the great pleasures of my career is to have that opportunity. It's been really great.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, sounds good. I will ask you at the end of the interview if there's any other project you're working on. But let's talk about this book a little bit. So After Darwin, so Cambridge has a series of books, After Darwin, After Marx, After Said. There are a lot of companions or handbooks to Darwin, and more recent in the past 10 years, maybe there have been a lot of books on Darwin and literature as well. So I'm interested to know what is particularly different about this book.
Well, I guess I'll field this one. We really take the after in the title quite seriously. So as you said, this is part of a series from Cambridge of after important thinkers. It's not a guidebook or a handbook to Darwin in the same way as the other books that you've mentioned, but rather it's really a series of provocations, engagements, interventions. It's a collection of essays that addresses the legacy of Darwinian thought in a variety of humanities disciplines, right? So they sort of think about the ways in which Darwinian thought has been taken up in diverse ways, but also suggest influences in the future. So we have essays on feminist theory, disability studies, race studies, sound studies. So there's all different kinds of humanities disciplines, philosophy, of course, as well. And the authors are really thinking about how to push forward, right? How to think about the ways in which Darwinian thought has been taken up, not necessarily in the present, because some of the essays are talking about the ways in which Darwinian thought influenced Darwin's contemporaries or people, thinkers in the 19th century, early 20th century. But the after is really the kind of key part there. So it's not really a volume of essays explicating Darwin as much as it is a volume of essays engaging with Darwin.
And I must say that in a number of the articles that I read in this book, I actually did learn a lot about Darwin myself, and it did correct some of the misconceptions I had about Darwinism. Since you're both literary scholars, just for the uninitiated, can you tell us briefly what is literary Darwinism and how did Darwin become popular with literary scholars? Because that's maybe the last thing somebody would think about. How did Darwin become popular with in literature departments? So Devin, you're on mute.
Thank you. I think our collection enters that question from a slightly different angle than you might expect. Because really to think about the intersection between literature and Darwin, there's sort of two disparate movements in literary studies. On the one hand, there's what's often called literary Darwinism. Writers like Brian Boyd or Joseph Carroll, Dennis Dutton have been thinking about how we can analyze how literature functions through a Darwinian lens. And so their basic approach, and it has a relationship to sociobiology and evolutionary psychology, is to take a certain methods, which they take to be sort of Darwinian methods of analysis, and think about, for instance, how does that explain the joke in Lewis Carroll, right? How does it explain how a romance plot functions in its character system? I, by contrast, and Deanna and this collection really come out of sort of a different orientation. So nobody in this collection, I think, is a sort of classic literary Darwinist, although we did have somebody who was involved with the project early on who wasn't able to sort of get their sort of chapter in on time. I feel like that's actually one of the holes in the collection, is not to have a sort of strictly literary Darwinist chapter. But we basically argue that Darwin's impact extends well beyond, both within the sciences and in the humanities, any sort of single set of techniques or philosophies. In particular, I think Darwin's impact as a thinker and as a philosopher is much larger than the theory of natural selection. And so one of the things that we sort of outline at the beginning of the collection is sort of how to think of him as a philosopher and a theorist of culture, as well as a biologist. And one of the sort of critiques that I would offer to literary Darwinists, I'm not the only one, is that often to sort of reify some small set of Darwin's methods, maybe overlook some of the wider breadth of his thinking, particularly when you think about literature, because the sort of timescales along which literature changes don't seem to map cleanly to, I think, the timescales on which things like biological entities evolve or change. And also, I think some of the ways in which culture operates don't sort of map cleanly into sort of the kind of categories that Darwin was initially imagining. Conversely, he's interested in things like aesthetics and beauty and diversity in ways that I don't see always reflected in literary Darwinist approaches.
Is it sort of an attempt to make, because, you know, with the rise of more interdisciplinary approaches to literature, would you say that it's an attempt to make literature more scientific, or literary criticism more scientific?
I would say the short answer is no. it depends on what you mean by scientific, of course, right? Mm-hmm. But if by scientific we mean something like more quantitative or more positivist, then no. I mean, obviously there are kind of attempts and movements and interest in quantifying literature, things like large language models or, you know, digital humanities, distant reading, all those kinds of approaches. That's not really what we're doing in this volume. That said, I mean, the contributors here are really interested in that long history of the interplay between science and literature. And we do talk about that in the introduction as well. Mm-hmm. We mentioned that we take as a point of departure Gillian Beer and George Levine, who, you know, wrote Darwin's plots, and George Levine wrote a lot about Darwin and novelists. Stretching back to now 30, 40 years ago, I think Darwin's plots, shockingly, is like 40 years old now, which is kind of incredible to me. But and of course, what they did in that work that was sort of revolutionary at the time was to argue that there's a two-way interplay between literature and science, that the novelists are being influenced by Darwinian thought and, of course, are taking up those models and modes of thinking about the scale of the human life, et cetera. That's a phrase from Gillian Beer. But conversely, right, novelistic plot is also influencing science and influencing the way that Darwin is thinking as well. I mean, he did read widely. He was a voracious reader, loved Austin, loved other, you know, authors, contemporary authors. So it really is kind of thinking about that mutual influence. So that's sort of straying from the original question a little bit, but I would say we're not looking to be, I personally, anyway, maybe Devin has a different answer to this, but I personally am not interested in trying to make literary study more scientific in that reductionist way, right? But rather thinking about the ways in which they're mutually influencing, mutually constitutive, it's a two-way conversation. Oh, you're muted still, Devin. Sorry.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. We're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
That's really well put, Dee. I think that one way to think about it is if literary Darwinism tries to take scientific methods and apply it to literary study, this other sort of approach to Darwin we're talking about takes sort of literary historical and philosophical methods and applies it to thinking about the history and practice of science, right? Mm-hmm. So how is it that the scientific imagination is structured by the sort of conceptual and imaginative protocols that they drive from literature? Mm-hmm. And so it is sort of completing the circuit, doing something more two-way. I mean, one of the things that Beer and Levine were responding to was an earlier generation of scholars who were thinking about the history of ideas, figures like A.O. Lovejoy, who really were focused on the question of how scientific practice shaped ideas in the wider culture. And their argument was, well, let's flip that question around and ask how literature affects science. And Darwin ends up being a really wonderful example of this, precisely because his work is so deeply imaginative and engaging and so wide ranging in both the sort of attempt to grasp the natural world and what he observes, but also communicate in an effective way to his readers.
In the introduction of your book, you talk about how the idea of struggle for existence is often misunderstood. So how did Darwin originally look at it, and why is it that it's generally misunderstood by people?
I'd be happy to take this one. So it turns out struggle for existence isn't a term that he coined. Actually, Charles Lyell, the geologist who was one of Darwin's mentors and also sort of a founder of modern geology, coined this phrase in precisely the sort of sense we usually take it to mean. He was looking at the way in which creatures struggle in the world against each other, and he was starting to think already about what the consequences were for those creatures over the long run. What's really important, though, in the case of Darwin, is when Darwin first introduces that term in The Origin of Species, he initially says one will tend to think of this in the sense of two creatures struggling. But he says more basically, we should imagine it rather as the struggle for all life simply to exist. And the example he gives, which is really telling, is the example of a plant struggling to survive on the edge of a desert. What he really wanted to emphasize is, even though we're always focused on these narratives of competition, more basically, life itself struggles to hang on in the face of the sort of remorselessness of wider natural systems. You know, he's writing really right at the cusp of people understanding what the implications of entropy and thermodynamics are, something that Darwin himself, I don't think, ever really conceptualized or understood. But I think he recognized that essentially, in a widest sphere, the natural world is not hospitable to life. And so the ability for life to hang on and proceed and thrive, that's the more basic boundary condition for life itself. And within that wider boundary condition, individual struggles between organisms are one case. But he was also equally focused, and I would say in the second half of his career, far more focused on the question of cooperation and mutual evolution between things like pollinators and flowers. And I'd be happy to say more about that. But I think missing that side of Darwin's thought and that sort of turn towards ecology and interrelation and a form of cooperation is one of the great sort of injustice is done to his legacy in a lot of sort of popular science, even I think sometimes by some scientists.
Mm-hmm. And I'll go back to what Diana said earlier. She talked about how Darwin was an avid reader himself and he loved literature. And I could be wrong, but I read somewhere that he didn't like Shakespeare very much. I could be wrong, but that's what I read. I read a quote from him anyhow. So Darwin also, not only Darwin, but I guess a lot of scientists at that time, but let's talk about Darwin. He also used this literary style to convey his ideas. So how did he consider fiction? What did he think of fiction? Was it antithesis to fact or science?
Well, about that literary style, first of all, I mean, I think this is something that is very striking to people, maybe if they haven't actually read Darwin himself, right? I mean, a lot of people know about Darwin's ideas, or they come to them second or third hand or through summaries or whatever. When you actually read Darwin, it's surprising, I think, to a 21st century reader expecting, or, you know, who has a kind of set of expectations of what scientific writing is like. Darwin's writing is really literary and creative, right? He uses storytelling in order to kind of convey some of the information that would be difficult, I think, for his readers to capture otherwise. So, for example, you know, these kind of vast timescales that he's talking about in that Lyellian geology sense, right, of like trying to kind of imaginatively sketch out for his readers what those kinds of timescales are like, or fleshing out where there's gaps or fissures in the historical record, the fossil record, et cetera. He fills in those ideas with a kind of creative style. His writing is full of literary devices. He uses like sophisticated fictional techniques. To describe discoveries, he invites the reader to draw inferences from his descriptions of the natural world, right? And I think it's also important to remember too that there didn't used to be such a disciplinary divide between science and humanities. Darwin was not, you know, he doesn't have a PhD in biology, right? He was trained as a doctor, sort of. I don't think he actually even finished his medical degree, right? Or maybe he did, but he never really did anything with it now. And, you know, he just hops on a boat and decides, I guess I'll just go be a naturalist. This is one of my favorite things about 19th century scientists is that, you know, they just wake up one morning and decide, I'm a cell biologist. I'm going to go get some vials and start collecting stuff. And lo and behold, they're a cell biologist. That's, you know, basically the story of George Henry Lewis, who's George Eliot's partner. So I think, you know, he's a passionate amateur who becomes an extraordinarily important scientific thinker. And I think that's also reflected in his writing as well. His writing's actually really beautiful. You know, as literary scholars, I think one of the reasons that we appreciate him and are attracted to him is because he is a good writer. I actually, in anticipation here, I actually went and looked up again the ending of The Origin of Species. It's a very famous quotation about the tangled bank. And so I'm just going to read a little bit here. From the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone circling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. I mean, that's just lovely, right? I mean, I think it's, you know, a testament to that kind of education, right? That kind of, you know, all around sort of humanist slash scientific education where there wasn't such a division between the two and there was an appreciation for the literary. And I think we really see that in his writing.
How about philosophy? It's impossible, right, to read the history of philosophy without coming across the name of Darwin. Did he consider himself a philosopher or more an empiricist? Or why is it that his works have been more associated? I mean, have also been widely discussed in philosophy as well.
That's a great question. I mean, the short answer to that is yes, Darwin was a philosopher, and he would absolutely hate it if we called him so. I think, really went out of his way to avoid being perceived as a philosopher. He was writing in a time when there had been a really hard turn towards a more empirical, increasingly professional Baconian scientific method. Everything was supposed to be inductive rather than deductive. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons why it took him about almost 20 years to sort of work upon the basic theory and then finally publish The Origin of Species, and he would have taken far longer if he wasn't anticipated by Alfred Russel Wallace, is simply that he wanted to assemble enough facts and observations through this wide network of correspondence that it didn't look like a theory anymore at some basic level, or at least it didn't look so speculative. And there are lots of good reasons for that. One of the most important, I think, is his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who was a major philosopher and poet and medical scientist. And his grandfather felt no compunction at all about publishing wildly speculative theories at the close of the 18th century. And when, with a sort of conservative turn in science and in politics, and in culture, his grandfather was sort of excoriated for his sort of radical thought, political thought, as well as philosophical ideas. Darwin's entire family, I think, took a lesson, which is you can't be that kind of thinker, at least not publicly. That said, you know, when you go look at Darwin's journals or when you look at his letters, you see how sort of wildly fanciful and speculative he actually was. You know, the Darwin Correspondence Project has a lot of their stuff already online. So you can sort of look through his letters. There's a wonderful website called Darwin Online that sort of has his journals all digitized. So you can like look through his is the notebooks as he's sort of working on evolution. And it's really, really fun to watch him speculate, imagine, and theorize. He called this building castles in the air, a phrase that pops up all the time. So he understood himself, I think, as a theorist, as a speculator. He was afraid of the term philosopher, right? But ultimately, one of the things I'm really excited about our collection getting across is the sort of philosophical underpinnings of the ideas he's working with are really profound, and we're still coming to terms with them today. And you can see that and sort of track it out in terms of his impact on different philosophers, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the points we make is figures like Nietzsche or Whitehead or Freud, all of them understood themselves as working in one way or another in the sort of shadow of Darwin and Darwinian philosophy, whether it comes to thinking about the evolution function of the mind or thinking about what's called process philosophy, which is sort of thinking about the sort of processual nature of both living creatures and sort of the wider natural world. I think he posed a lot of provocations to philosophy that we're really still trying to deal with. And I think at some level, he's going to stay for a long time and continue to be this engine of philosophical ideas, precisely because he was confronting something so radically new and challenging that you know, philosophy and humanists in general are still trying to wrap our heads around it.
Yeah, I just jump in really quickly and say, I think this is a really huge topic, but I just, what you mentioned, Devin, the part about Darwin's own anxieties about how he's being perceived as a scientific thinker. It's really interesting to me to think about how he's really kind of at this fulcrum point in the 19th century of that shift from the amateur grandiose speculator, right, to that highly, and we see this in political economy too, with the shift from political economy to economics, with the rise of the marginal utility theory and calculus and all that good stuff. That's actually my specialty, original specialty is political economy and economics in the novel. And he's really just kind of right there. So you can see he has kind of one foot on each sand dune, right? Where it's like, you know, he has this kind of speculative philosophical tradition that he's working in, but also that sort of anxiety almost about being perceived as a professional, just as those shifts are taking place and professionalization is happening in the university, et cetera. So he's a really interesting figure for that reason too.
Yeah, I love that, Dee, because the sort of relation between economy and ecology and ecosystem science remains sort of so important today in terms of thinking. And for me, if I had to put a marker on sort of the most important sort of philosophical challenge that he introduced, I think it's the problem of ecology itself, by which I mean, up until Darwin, more or less, people believed in some sort of benevolent force or entity out there holding natural systems together, that they were sort of wired providentially to work at some basic level. And Darwin stripped away that confidence or belief. And the problem that we still wrestle with today is, how do we understand the complexity of what we see around us in nature? Also the complexity of human impacts on nature in terms of pollution, global warming, and environmental degradation. How do we understand that complexity? I think one of the things, this sort of gets back to the question of his relationship to literature. One thing I've been thinking about a lot is how when we tell stories, we tend to emphasize conflict. And there aren't a lot of great models for storytelling structures, which are about sort of cooperation, right? Because structures of conflict precipitate sort of crises and resolutions, right? They sort of, at least in the Western tradition, sort of hold together a lot of the components of narrative theory. And as Darwin sort of tried to figure out how does he describe the world around him, I think he was really sensitive to his tendency to fall into that trap of constantly describing what he was seeing in terms of conflicts between organisms, which is why I think that struggle for existence metaphor is so interesting. I think he saw that beyond these narratives of competition, there's a wider question of interaction and sort of transformation and emergence that there just weren't great models for. And I think that truthfully, in biology and modern ecology and evolutionary science, people are still trying to figure out how do we explain the development of these systems, their complex interaction, without resorting exclusively to competitive models, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a problem he really, I think, saw. And he spent the second half of his career trying to figure out. And I think we're very far from really having a satisfactory answer to it.
Mm-hmm. What about the role of aesthetics? That's another aspect of his works that you discuss in the book. What is the role of aesthetics in his writing?
I'll take a stab at this, although I know Devin has a lot to say about this as well. I mean, most There's actually been a bunch of interesting work. I mean, I think primarily a first of Elizabeth Gross and other people writing about Darwin's aesthetics in terms of feminist theory and philosophy. But most discussions of Darwin's aesthetics focus on the descent, which is where he developed, of course, the theory of sexual selection or mate choice as a crucial piece of the evolutionary mechanism, right? So alongside natural selection, there's this other force or this other kind of mode. And what's interesting about sexual selection is that it doesn't privilege fitness or function, right? In fact, quite the opposite, as he makes the point over and over again in laying out his examples of mate choice in the animal kingdom, that in fact, often mates are preferred for structures that are not only have no particular function or do not aid in fitness, but are even detrimental, right? In some instances. So why is it that creatures have evolved these extraordinarily elaborate forms in order to attract mates that are not actually also conducive to fitness? So, the answer is, this is like just a very basic cartoony way of putting it, but, this is the aesthetic dimension, right? The aesthetic dimension of sexual selection. And it challenges reductionist views of Darwinian thought as deterministic, right? So in other words, we can't... to go back to that kind of literary Darwinist thing that Devin was talking about before, if, one of the things that evolutionary psychology kind of gets, into a little bit of trouble with, or it's often challenged or pushed back against, is this idea that there's a very deterministic kind of, there's evolutionary changes happened in the past, and that kind of sets the program for the future, right? That like, because, this particular set of behaviors or structures or whatever helped us in the Neolithic period or whatever, the Paleolithic period, that therefore they're kind of, set in stone, sorry, no pun intended, set in lith. And there's no room for further development, and then of course that raises the whole can of worms too about, acculturation versus physical structures, et cetera. But anyway, to kind of get back to the aesthetics thing, that love of excitement or novelty, that's the phrase that Darwin uses, introduces a kind of, in addition to aesthetic pleasure, a notion of radical uncertainty or even freedom, right? And so I think, there's a whole kind of huge, like I said, body of work about this that thinks about the interplay or relationship between, say, feminist theory or even race studies, et cetera, and that aesthetic dimension of Darwin's thought. So that's just a kind of an opening salvo. And I'm sure Devin has more to say about this because I know it's kind of a pet topic.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh yeah, it's something I'm totally fascinated by.
Yeah,
working on currently, but I want to pick it up right where Dee left off there, which is thinking about the relationship between aesthetics and race within the humanities. In general, I think there's a lot of awareness and sort of focus on studying how do certain sort of aesthetic paradigms privilege certain races over others, or even more specifically, kind of generate racist ideologies and perpetuate them over time. And one of the really interesting accounts that we've received. Or readings of Darwin that sort of been developed over the last 20, 30 years is an analysis of what he's doing with aesthetics as sort of an anti-racist way of thinking about nature. And so, Kwame Appiah first made this argument. We've got a great chapter by E. Ricardo Brown in our collection where he really lays this out. But what they point out is that in The Descent of Man, Darwin argues that the variety of humans' tastes, the sort of the fact that different people like different things is a sort of a window into how we differentiate sort of phenotypically, just in terms of how we look. And his argument is it's entirely superficial. In other words, the basic structures that anatomists pay attention to for species differentiation, and humans are all the same. So he's very deeply committed to the idea that humans are all the same. We just superficially look different. And he uses aesthetics as a way to explain that, rather than as a way of arguing that there's some essential nature that distinguishes between the races, right? So for him, thinking about the variety of people's tastes and how divergent that could be and the directions it could lead is a way to argue against racial essentialism, which I think is sort of important and sort of still an important sort of opening for a way to think about the sort of liberatory potential of an aesthetic theory as over against sort of the modern history of racial thinking. And the other direction that I'm really interested in too, and I think it sort of dovetails with it, and Elizabeth Grosch is somebody who helped me see this, is that Darwin basically starts working on aesthetics right after The Origin of Species when he turns to the question of flowers, or actually he doesn't so much turn to it. He's initially trying to write a bigger book on biology and natural selection, but he gets kind of captured by his fascination with flowers and their pollinators. And as he sort of explores sort of how orchids are, for instance, fertilized by wasps and other insects, he realizes that all this beauty in the natural world in terms of floral life isn't meant for us. Up until that point, there'd been a really strong commitment to this notion of the natural world, and especially its aesthetic dimension is for human perception, designed by God. Sort of philosophers like Thurl of Shaftesbury actually made our ability to sort of appreciate beauty in nature, the thing that made us human and distinct from the animal. And he sort of argued, forcefully, animals can't appreciate beauty. Darwin sort of demolishes that by arguing that precisely what we respond to in a flower has some relationship to what a wasp sees or what a bee sees. And that sense of appreciation, desire that we feel has a kind of connection to what those insects feel. He even argues that plants have kind of feelings and sensations too. Even more radically, he's arguing that there is a sort of sensorium for plant life, and that sensorium can be sort of accessed and studied by means of our own engagements with those plants and thinking about the way that they sort of engage with the world around, which is a really radical proposal, I think, by itself, because it demolishes a lot of our claims and distinctions between plant and animal life on the one hand, and then between the animal and the human on the other. But the sort of further turn to that, I think, is from that point forward, he's really focused on not just the aesthetic, but other modes, but the aesthetic's a great example. How does that open a window into the way that ecologies interact in general, right? How is it that we can use the sort of aesthetic systems that underwrite nature as a window into what sort of holds these systems together in the face of a sort of unfriendly wider cosmos? And so I think that's a problem he keeps pursuing. And there's, I think, tons of room for us to pursue it today. There's an anthropologist named Eduardo Cohn who wrote a book called How Forests Think, which is all about the sort of semiotic systems that hold together nature and sort of our engagement and immersion in those systems. And I think more fundamentally, Darwin offers a way to think about aesthetics itself, our perception, not just of beauty and pleasure, but also of pain, sort of our sensations and our engagement with the natural world through those sensations as something that pulls us into the natural environment and exposes the way in which we're immersed in it, rather than something that sort of makes us unique or abstracts us from nature in some basic way. So I don't know, the ecological aesthetics, I think, is one way I've been thinking about it. I think that's maybe one of the more important provocations that we're still trying to work through in terms of his thinking.
I think it's really interesting, just when you're talking, Devin, I just suddenly had a kind of one of those little glimpses of kind of something clicking, right? Where thinking about that kind of, it's almost a paradox between the idea of the aesthetic dimension having a kind of liberatory potential or being a realm of freedom, and at the same time, it also being yet another way in which Darwinian thought decenters the human, right? That like, you know, the flowers are not there for us. It's completely accidental or contingent that we have, you know, whatever appreciation that we have of them. They're not meant to attract us. They're meant to attract wasps or bees or whatever, right? And so here we are, kind of decentered and yet also, you know, having this kind of space of freedom. And it seems like a kind of a weird paradox a little bit, but I just suddenly had one of those little epiphanies when you were talking.
I love that, Dee. I'd like just building off of that, I would say it really focuses on the question of liberation for what and for whom, right? And redefining what we mean by freedom. And I think another way of thinking about the climate crisis at a broad scale and current economic and social crises at another is reevaluating the terms in which freedom has often been understood, and sort of the question of what sort of liberation looks like, and particularly what it would mean to try to liberate parts of nature to some degree, right? but also those who've been subject to the sort of worst depredations of extractivism and sort of our violent impact on populations and on natural systems. So I think, you know, there's a whole cluster of things here to talk about, but these are words I'm thinking about, I guess is what I'll say.
You've given us a lot of food for thought, great answers to the questions. And just before we come to the end of this interview, could you broadly talk about the structure of the book? The book has three parts and about 15 articles. So can you broadly tell us about the topics and themes that the contributors have covered in this book?
The overall structure, it's divided into three parts. And I feel like, as with so many edited collections like this, of course, it's a slightly arbitrary division in that some essays could obviously belong in more than one section. But the broad kind of sections are environments after Darwin, in which we have some essays that talk about, should we list, like we can quickly list Jesse Oak Taylor.
Yeah.
Caroline Hovanec, Miranda Butler, and Alan McDuffie are in that section. And they're all writing roughly about environmental humanities issues, animal studies, Anthropocene issues, right? And then we've got Differences After Darwin and Humanism After Darwin. Maybe, Devin, I'll let you talk about those two sections.
Yeah, the second part, Differences After Darwin, we've got contributions by Travis Chewing Lau, B. Ricardo Brown, I mentioned him earlier. Kathleen Fredrickson, Carol Colatrella, and Weichi Dimock. And sort of, we're really focusing in here on the sort of question of how Darwin changes the understanding of what difference means in ways that sort of challenge racism, certain constructions of disability, certain understandings of sex and gender, and sort of how also he's played into the history of sort of feminist thought. So it's a really interesting section, I think, talking about sort of the sort of power of his philosophy as a critical philosophy that sort of undermines or challenges certain sort of widely held norms in alignment with a lot of current scholarship. And the last section is on sort of humanism after Darwin, and which is kind of a catch-all category, I admit, but there's some really wonderful essays by Ian Duncan, mm-hmm. Patrick Fessenbaker, and Nicolaj Nodelman, Alexis Harley, Angelique Richardson, and Hans Sasse, thinking about how Darwinian theory and writing helps us rethink history and philosophy and sort of traditional sort of disciplines of humanist study. There's a really great section here to thinking about Darwin and the sublime, and also sort of Darwin's relationship to the comparative method and the way that we sort of use analogies today, which I think he's had a really big impact on. And after that final section, we have a beautiful afterword by George Levine, who, along with Gillian Beer, is one of the great founders of sort of the study of Darwin and literature. And he sort of reflects on the collection and also, I think, poignantly reflects on his career, having been sort of working mm-hmm. in this area for, at this point, more than 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah, we're really, really lucky and happy that he did that for us, because it was very gracious of him to to put his golden finger at the end of our collection.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because I asked George about it. He said, well, I don't know if I'll have anything to add to this. And then, of course, he had a million things to add. Yeah. As insightful as ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Professor Devin Griffiths and Deanna Crazel, thank you very, very much for your time to talk with us on New Books Network. This is a wonderful book that I strongly recommend our listeners to pick up and read. Lots of articles on different topics. After Darwin, Literature Theory Criticism in 21st Century, published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marteza. This was wonderful. I appreciate it.
It's really fun.